Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparola. Concerts by the CSO on Thursday, February 6th through Saturday, the 8th, feature guest conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen. The program includes Beethoven's Symphony No. 2, and then after intermission, the orchestra is joined by two singers, mezzo-soprano Ekaterina Gubanova, bass baritone Christian Van Horn, and narrator Breezy Lee for a performance of the one-act opera Bluebeard's Castle by Béla Bartók. Here are Philip Huscher's program notes on the Beethoven Second Symphony, a work lasting about 34 minutes. A young man doesn't expect to go deaf, and so Beethoven was both surprised and frightened when he admitted to himself a musician's worst nightmare, that he was having trouble hearing. We can't be certain when he first acknowledged his cruel fate, but he apparently kept it a secret for a number of years. In June 1801, he finally confessed to his dear friend Franz Wegeler, who also happened to be a doctor, "For almost 2 years, I have ceased to attend any social functions just because I find it impossible to say to people, I am deaf." By then, Beethoven was worried. He had already sought treatment from a number of doctors who prescribed hot and cold baths, olive oil, pills, and infusions. To no avail, his ears continued to hum and buzz. Young Karl Czerny, on his first visit to Beethoven, probably in 1800, noticed with the visual quickness peculiar to children, as he later recalled, that he had cotton, which seemed to have been steeped in a yellowish liquid, in his ears. Czerny didn't think of it again until he, like much of the music world, heard rumors that Beethoven was hard of hearing. Beethoven found no relief until he turned to Dr. Johann Adam Schmidt, a professor of general pathology and therapy, who seemed full of sympathy and optimism. Apparently, it was Dr. Schmidt who, among his other prescriptions, recommended that Beethoven abandon Vienna for rural Heiligenstadt. In late April of 1802, Beethoven left for the pastoral suburb that to this day is known for the document he wrote there some 6 months later. The Heiligenstadt Testament, as it has come to be called, was begun on October 6th and finished 4 days later. It's addressed to the composer's brothers, Karl and Johann. Although Beethoven's hearing would deteriorate considerably in later years, 1802 marked the moment of crisis. The Heiligenstadt Testament includes Beethoven's admission that his malady was permanent and incurable. He didn't fail to see the horrible irony of an infirmity in the one sense which ought to be more perfect in me than in others. This, surprisingly, is the background for Beethoven's Second Symphony, one of his most energetic, cheerful, and outgoing works. Beethoven surely had begun the D major symphony before he packed for Heiligenstadt that spring. He finished it there sometime that autumn in a setting very like the one he would later depict in the Pastoral Symphony. When his student Ferdinand Ries came to visit Beethoven, he called attention to a shepherd who was piping very agreeably in the woods on a flute made of a twig or elder. For half an hour Beethoven could hear nothing, and though I assured him that it was the same with me, which was not the case, he became extremely quiet and morose. The D major symphony, like no other music written at the time, shows no sign of Beethoven's obvious despair. It's possible that Beethoven put the finishing touches on the confident, rollicking finale of his Second Symphony only days before he confessed thoughts of suicide in the letter to his brothers. After Beethoven returned to Vienna, his hearing and his spirits both unimproved, he began to make plans for a major concert of his music to be held on April 5, 1803, which would include not only his new symphony, but also the premieres of his third piano concerto and the oratorio, Christ on the Mount of Olives. That concert, conducted by the composer, achieved the combination, not unknown in our own time, of mixed reviews and a box office bonanza. Although Beethoven and his audience considered Christ on the Mount of Olives the main attraction, the Second Symphony would ultimately triumph. One reporter decided on the spot that the First Symphony is better than the latter one, although he did acknowledge that Beethoven seemed to be striving for the new and surprising. Around this time, Beethoven said to a friend, I am only a little satisfied with my previous works. From today, I will take a new path. That path was forged primarily by the daring venture of the Eroica Symphony. But the Second Symphony is already a sign of fresh things to come, and it's a great advance over the first. The influential Beethoven biographer Maynard Solomon calls it both retrospective and prospective. It still Haydn's orchestra, pairs of winds with horns, trumpets, timpani, and strings, and the layout of his last 12 symphonies, four movements with a slow introduction and a rondo finale that serve as Beethoven's starting point. This is music that Haydn would have understood but couldn't have written. Beethoven's slow introduction is a full 33 measures of powerful, expansive music, rich in the kind of dramatic gesture he would later exploit so famously. The ensuing Allegro con brio crackles with a nervous energy and maintains an all-business edge unprecedented in symphonic music. The Larghetto, on the other hand, moves at a gracious and easy pace that's rare for this composer. Leisure wasn't to Beethoven's taste. Several years later, when he devised the misguided notion of arranging this symphony for piano trio, he added quasi andante to the Larghetto, marking to keep things moving. Instead of the minuet and trio combination third movement of the Haydn model, it served Beethoven well in his own first symphony. Beethoven now writes scherzo, forever changing the complexion of the standard symphonic design. Beethoven's scherzo, more compact than many of Haydn's minuets, is wildly playful with just enough weight to suggest the drama that's already present in Beethoven, even when he's playing games. The explosive finale is what we now call pure Beethoven, although audiences in 1803 didn't yet know what that meant and no doubt found it shocking and unpredictable with its cultish movement and energy and its uninhibited, nose-thumbing sense of humor. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Beethoven's Symphony No. 2. And now on to Bluebeard's Castle by Béla Bartók. The performance time is about 59 minutes. Bluebeard first appears in the pages of Charles Perrault's Mother Goose Tales in the company of Tom Thumb and Little Red Riding Hood. There was an actual Bluebeard, a 15th century dandy named Gilles de Retz, who dyed his beard blue, dressed in the best silks and jewels, and is said to have committed a number of crimes, although the cold-blooded murder of his six wives is not among them. Perrault added that detail in his 1697 collection. Bluebeard's newest bride discovers the heads of her predecessors neatly hanging behind a closed door. In the 200 years between Perrault and Bartók, this legend took many forms and eventually made its way to the world of opera. Grétry's Rue Barbleu, Offenbach's Barbleu, and Ducas's setting of Maeterlinck's Ariane Barbleu were the most successful. Ducas's version was only 4 years old in 1911 when Béla Bartók began to write his first and only opera, which is also based on the Bluebeard legend. Bartók took a text already prepared by his fellow countryman Bala Balázs for Zoltán Kodály, who never used it. In Balázs's version, the drama is compressed into one act with only two characters. The former wives, of which there are only now three, are mute, and Balázs renames the newest bride Judith, or Judit. The basic stages of the drama can be quickly summarized. The aging Bluebeard, Quetzalcoatl, and his young bride Judith enter the dark, vast, circular hall of his castle. There are no windows, only seven massive doors. Judith vows that their love will bring sunlight and joy to the castle. Bluebeard says it can never be. She insists on knowing what is behind the seven locked doors. Finally, Bluebeard gives her the first key, and thus begins the terrifying series of discoveries that seals Judith's own fate. The first six doors produce one, a torture chamber, its walls weeping blood. Two, an armory, the weapons of war, all stained with blood. Three, great wealth and treasure, the jewels bathed in blood. 4, a perfumed garden, its soil soaked with blood. 5, a vast panorama of the countryside, with clouds casting a bloody shadow. And 6, still waters, a great lake of tears. Bluebeard begs Judith to leave the last 7th door unopened. Fearing that she already knows the truth, she insists. The 7th door is unlocked, revealing Bluebeard's 3 previous wives. Bluebeard introduces the 1st, who came at dawn, the 2nd, who came at midday, and the 3rd, who came at twilight. And now Judith, who came in the night sown with stars, joins the others behind the 7th door. The door closes, and Bluebeard is left in darkness. As Peter Bartok, the composer's son, has written, Bluebeard represents man as a tragic figure. In fulfilling his nature, he must forego joy and satisfaction. He must suffer and make others suffer. Seeking truth, he is obligated to sacrifice happiness. Judith is woman as the embodiment of love. She loves Bluebeard because he is the essential man, the unhappy seeker of uncompromising and joyless truth. She wants to redeem him, to reconcile him with life, to make him accept happiness. All 3 of Bartok's stage works, the others are the ballets The Wooden Prince and The Miraculous Mandarin, focus on the relationship between man and woman. In Bluebeard's Castle, Bartok uses contrasting music to distinguish the two, the pentatonic and folk-like for Bluebeard, chromatic and romantic for Judith. These are the only singing roles, and the relationship between them is not defined by stock operatic gestures or forms. They sing to each other, but not together until the very end, and then only for a few measures. The symbolism is powerful. They cannot reach one another. The drama in Bluebeard's Castle is accomplished through music, not action. As the bard, who speaks the prologue, suggests, the stage on which the work unfolds may well be one of the mind. The opera begins and ends in total darkness with music based on a pentatonic scale using only 5 notes, starting on F sharp. But with the flood of light at the 5th door, Bartok unleashes a blinding flash of pure C major. Significantly, C is the note furthest from F sharp. That moment, capped by Judith's cry on a high C, comes at the very center of the piece and suggested to Bartok the arch form that became his favorite architectural plan. Bluebeard's Castle is a gradual crescendo from darkness to light and then back again. The opening of the doors invites orchestral music that is richly descriptive of each discovery. The horrors of the torture chamber are illustrated in chilling sounds from the entire orchestra. There are shrieks from the piccolos and a nervous trilling throughout. Trumpet and horn fanfares introduce the armory. Glistening patterns from the celesta and harps accompany the discovery of the jewels. The garden behind the 4th door is depicted in a pastoral horn theme over a wash of quiet string music. The broad vistas of Bluebeard's kingdom are scanned in slow progressions of brilliant triads, ceremonial and spine-tingling in the sheer power of their sound. Arpeggios from the celesta, harps, and winds suggest the immense waters behind the 6th door. At the 7th door, the drama is turned on its head. Judith has heard the rumors and believes the last door will reveal the bodies of Bluebeard's murdered wives, but the women are not dead. As Peter Bartok explains, in Balázs' symbolic version, representing Bluebeard as the prototype of tragic and creative man, the central motif of the old folktale, Bluebeard as the wicked wife-killer, is thoroughly sublimated. He concludes, No woman, then, can give Bluebeard joy and happiness on her own terms, as Judith had wanted to. The women are forever enshrined as figures of undying beauty in the secret recesses of the Castle of Gloom, which in its turn symbolized man's soul. Bluebeard's women make his flowers bloom and his treasures grow. In other words, they are the source of the creative man's inspiration. But as living women, they cannot share his life. They exist only as idealized memories. Without being a wife killer in the material sense, Bluebeard does kill his women on the inner stage. Tragic man can find no fulfillment in woman. This is the hidden meaning of the old tale. Bluebeard's castle is not often encountered in the opera house, partly because it must be paired with something else to make for a full evening, and it's difficult to find an ideal companion, and partly because its true power does not depend on stage effects, but on an uncompromising delivery of the music. During the composer's lifetime, Bluebeard's castle was rarely performed. As soon as the work was finished, Bartók entered it in an important national competition. The prize, a staged production, was denied Bartók because the jurors thought the work unperformable. Bluebeard's Castle was not staged for another 7 years. Shortly after the premiere, in Budapest, in May 1918, Bluebeard was banned throughout Hungary because its librettist, Balázs, was now a political exile. A production was announced to celebrate the composer's 50th birthday in 1931, but it did not materialize. Eventually, the opera was recognized as a work of singular power and brilliance, but the difficulties Bartók had endured getting Bluebeard's Castle produced soured him on writing for the stage ever again. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Béla Bartók's Bluebeard's Castle. My name is Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening. And now a sidebar about Bartók in Chicago. Béla Bartók's name was hardly known here when the Chicago Symphony Orchestra gave the U.S. premiere of his second piano concerto in March 1939. The orchestra had played only two works, the Suite for Orchestra and the Dance Suite in the 1920s, and nothing since. That would eventually change. Bartók came to Chicago in April 1940. By then, many of the important creative musicians of pre-war Europe had moved to America after Bartók's departure from his native Hungary in late 1940 in anticipation of the Nazi invasion. He joined them. As soon as it was announced that Bartók would be coming to this country to give the U.S. premiere of his Rhapsody No. 1 with violinist Joseph Szigeti at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., the Arts Club of Chicago, which had already hosted both Arnold Schoenberg and Paul Hindemith, invited him for a dinner recital evening. At the Arts Club, which was then housed in the Wrigley Building, Bartók joined John Weicker, the Chicago Symphony's concertmaster, in the Rhapsody only 6 days after the Washington premiere and played selections from his newest work for piano, Mikroskosmos, so new that it's just being published today, the Tribune reported on April 10th. The pianist, Artur Rubinstein, who was in Chicago a week earlier, told the Tribune that Bartók was one of the very few great pianist composers of our time. Bartók returned in November 1941 to make his debut as a pianist with the Chicago Symphony, conducted by second music director Frederick Stock. The work, once again, was the second piano concerto, a score that had still not been played in any other U.S. city. The New York Philharmonic did not add the work to its repertory until 1951, the Boston Symphony 11 years after that. In the meantime, the Chicago Symphony had already programmed all three of Bartók's piano concertos, the first of the American orchestras to do so. In the years after Bartok's death in 1945, his music slowly gained ground in the Chicago Orchestra's repertoire, particularly under music directors Fritz Reiner and Sir George Scholte, whom both studied with the composer at the Budapest Academy of Music in the early 20th century and became among his most important champions. It was Reiner, along with Josef Szigeti, who talked Serge Koussevitzky into offering Bartok the $1,000 fee for the landmark 1943 Concerto for Orchestra, which has become one of the anchors of the Chicago Symphony's 20th century repertoire. It was recorded by the orchestra under both Reiner and Scholte. 6 months after Scholte's death in 1997, his cremated remains were interred in a Budapest cemetery next to Bartok's plot. By now, the Chicago Symphony plays Bartok's music nearly every season, and certain pieces, the three piano concertos, the second violin concerto, music from The Miraculous Mandarin, music for strings, percussion, and celesta, and even the opera Bluebeard's Castle, are performed with a regularity the composer never lived to see. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.